Hello, and welcome to the Space Coast Pet Podcast, the podcast for pets and the people who love them. Now here's your host, veterinarian Dr. Roger Welton.
Happy Thursday morning to all you wonderful pet lovers, and welcome to the Space Coast Pet Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Roger Welton, a.k.a. Dr. Roger, practicing veterinarian, coming to you from the Florida Space Coast. What a glorious morning it is here in my home state of sunny Florida. I'm in my back Florida room in my little broadcasting station, overlooking my beautiful lake. Sun is rising. All the birds are out and about, including my own pet ducks that frolic with the wildlife during the day, spending their day out on the lake before later on I'll let them in for dinner in their protective coop where they stay the night. Oh, it's just one of those mornings that makes you really just feel lucky to be alive, and I really hope that all of you are enjoying a beautiful morning in your own rights. Today's topic is my favorite kind of veterinary specialist. You might be a little bit surprised about what I have to say about this, because there's going to be probably a lot more nuance than one would expect, so stick around. We do have an email comment coming from Caitlin. I believe I'm pronouncing that right. K-A-T-E-L-Y-N, Caitlin. And she is a repeat offender. She has contributed before. And I thank you, Caitlin, for taking a moment to provide another pithy email. Hi, Doc. I'm really glad you did the supplement episode. It's an excellent topic, and I'm glad another listener asked it. I appreciate you covering gut health and the benefits of probiotics and talking about arthritis prevention again. I can't speak for everyone who listens to your show, but I like tuning in, not just for your vet knowledge, but also for insights from one pet guardian to another. It makes sense that you wouldn't want to seem as a spokes or salesperson for a particular product, but if it works and it can help our animals live longer or more comfortably, perhaps it's worth mentioning explicitly by name. It's just a thought. This seems like a creative outlet for you, and I appreciate the content and time you dedicate to your listeners. Okay, so here's the topic. Snake bites. After a near miss with a cottonmouth while hiking in Brazos Bend, I realized I didn't know how to respond. I joined the National Snake Bite Support Group on Facebook to learn more. Below is their protocol. I'm amazed by the number of people who really have to advocate for themselves or pets when it comes to anti-venom. Here is a link to the group. It's really interesting. It's all really interesting. And what a great post this is, because this is a problem here in Florida as well. Just about anywhere where there's venomous snakes, which is just about everywhere, this is a serious issue. So anti-venom, boy, anti-venom is a challenge. Snake bite anti-venom is, or first off, before I get into this, Caitlin, thank you for all those kind words. That's just amazing. Love proactive listeners like you. You posted some great information here. This support group looks fantastic, and I'm going to post the link on the episode notes before we air. So if you want to see that link, just look at the show page, and I'll have the link there. Thank you for doing that. But snake bites, yeah. So anti-venom is really problematic for us because it's not always an easy supply, and it has a fairly short shelf life, perhaps, you know, a month at best. And so it's expensive, very, very expensive. So when it expires on your shelf, it's just cash out the door. And so most general practices don't carry it because we don't see snake bites often enough to warrant carrying it. It's just a big bad for business thing, and you hate to make a decision based on business, but I honestly see a snake bite come through my practice like once every couple years. But they do happen more often than that. That's just my chunk of clientele are generally more beach people than they are woods people. But here in Florida, our biggest issue is rattlesnakes and coral snakes. Now, the one that Caitlin brought up is called a cottonmouth. They're in a family of snakes called pit vipers, and pit vipers would also include rattlesnakes and would also include copperheads. And they can be quite dangerous. not as deadly as a coral snake. Coral snake, we're talking death without anti-venom and aggressive supportive therapy, really within 25 to 30 minutes. Whereas cottonmouth, you know, let's say just gonna put them all together, the cottonmouth, the copperhead, the rattlesnake, all the pit vipers, they're generally not going to be quite as venomous. It also depends on the size of the snake and the number of bites. You have an exceptionally large snake and a very large or a very small dog, for example, or even a large dog that got bit by a large snake maybe multiple times. It is dependent on the number of bites and the size of the snake in proportion to the size of the dog. I can't say I've ever seen a cat bit by a snake. I'm sure it happens. They seem to be smarter about staying away from them. I'm sure, you know, plenty of cats out there that might get bit by a coral snake may not ever make it home in time for the owner to find them. So, you know, we do see those indoor-outdoor cats that go out one day and never to be seen again. One has to wonder, you know, how many venomous snakes get to those kitty cats versus bobcats and alligators and other things that we have here in Florida. But really, really good information here. So when it comes to the cottonmouths, the rattlesnakes, and the copperheads, you know, you end up at your general vet or you're at an emergency clinic who they really try to stock anti-venom because they're going to see it on a more regular basis. Because, like, I get a call in the middle of the day and a dog got bit by a snake, I'm turfing them to the emergency clinic because they have the anti-venom. Certainly, if it's coral snake, without the anti-venom, there is a really high mortality rate. But with the pit vipers, it's a little bit different. There actually is a decent amount of survivability even without anti-venom. But I would say if you have access to anti-venom and you can get to a place that has it, definitely that's going to be your preference. But most veterinarians should be decently versed in supportive treatment for snake bites. You know, again, a coral snake is going to have a high mortality rate without anti-venom, but hey, it's worth a try. So here's what we do. They come through the door and we give them shock doses of fluids. The fluids are going to do two things. They're going to increase lymphatic circulation, which is going to increase the tendency for the venom to ooze out of the wound. So the first thing I do is I throw an IV in them. We start shock doses of fluids. The next thing you need to do is address the wound itself. But before I do that, I'm going to give them an intravenous opiate. Because these bites are very painful, and to be able to work on them, you want to be able to give the dog some comfort. Always want to avoid non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. Those can increase the tendency to bleed and bruise, and we don't want that. The venom has a vasodilating effect on the blood vessels, which makes it tend to bleed more. So we don't want to contribute to that. We also want to avoid steroids. Steroids can be very helpful with inflammation and reduction of edema in a lot of different types of injuries, but they don't seem to do much of anything here. And so I'm just going to spare the potential immune suppression and not go with steroids. What we want to do, though, is put really rinse out that wound with sterile saline. We want to get it as clean as we possibly can. And then what I do is I apply what are called wet to dry bandages. So I take saline and I wet down gauze sponges. So not like just gauze. I'm talking like the we call them laparotomy sponges that we actually use to sponge up blood in, you know, when we're doing intra-abdominal surgeries. You'll be able to really, really saturate those things. And you put them right on the wound and you wrap it in cast padding and you wet that down also in saline. And then you surround that with dry cast padding. And you understand the wet to dry. So we got a wet layer that's going to go into a dry layer. And then we put an adhesive bandage around that and we leave that on. We change that out every hour over like 24 hours. What wet to dry bandages do is they create a wicking effect. So essentially, the wet layer going into the dry layer is going to pull the wetness towards it by what's called capillary action. And then by virtue of that, the wet layer will pull venom and fluid and, you know, bad stuff out of the wound directly. And so that's our direct wound treatment. And we're going to, you know, maybe be able to back that off to every 3 hours the next day. But that first day, you want to be really aggressive about changing those out. If we're not, if you're in a general practice setting, most general practices are not open 24 hours. So you'll want to, you know, either have that done in an emergency clinic, or you want to take shifts in your household and, you know, got a rotating schedule to get that done. That first 24 hours is crucial. One of the things that Caitlin provided was a protocol from a veterinarian as far as treating these bites and things that are indicated, not indicated, not necessarily indicated, but of no benefit. I'm going to disagree with one of these. I mean, this generally looks like very good information, but the one thing I'll disagree with is the antibiotics. These actually really like to get infected, and that infection in combination with the venom could lead to necrosis. So this vet says they're of no benefit unless at some point there is evidence of infection. But infection is not going to be there right out of the gate, right? It's gonna manifest within, you know, 2 to 3 days, and then by the time it manifests, you're potentially looking at a pretty nasty festering infection. So I don't want to wait till it gets to that point. So for me, I'm going to respectfully disagree with this particular veterinarian, and I'm going to give him intravenous cefazolin, which is a really good antibiotic for skin infections. And then once we are discharging the patient, we're going to do about a week of cephalexin, which is in the same family, but we're going to be able to do that orally. But I will post this link. As far as survivability, though, of the pit vipers, I will say, you know, not to necessarily despair if you don't have access to antivenom. You put in these protocols quickly. If you know it was a snake bite, you know, get that care on board as soon as possible. I would say the majority of these patients are going to survive this. You know, unless there, again, is a major bite to size of patient ratio in terms of the size of the snake in comparison to the pet, or the number of the bites in comparison to the size of the pet. But the more you can, you know, get to that area and treat it directly, get that venom out of there, the less likely it has the opportunity to go through the bloodstream and into the lymphatic system and wreak havoc in a systemic manner. So great topic, Caitlin. Thank you so much for your contribution. As far as today's topic, my favorite type of specialist. So before I get into this, I am not here to disparage any specialist that went the direct route. So the direct route means that you go to veterinary school and then you apply for what's called a rotating internship. The rotating internship is going to take you through all the different specialties of veterinary medicine and surgery. And you're going to do that at a university level or a major referral center level, where you're getting paid very little to work a lot of hours, but the payoff is that you're seeing referral level cases managed at a referral level, meaning that it's going to be the gold standard thrown at every one of these cases. And you're going to get to sit in rounds with specialists, with residents that work below them, with interns that work below them. There's round table discussions about every single case that's going on in the hospital in that particular discipline. And it's incredible. It's great. It's a great education, a great way to be headed towards the realm of the veterinary specialist, where you're specializing in a particular discipline. The next step after rotating internship is you apply for a residency. Then you pluck in a residency, and once you're a resident, then you're really specializing in that craft, and you're working under senior residents, and you're working under clinicians that are specialists. There's also generally usually teachers in the university teaching hospital. They also teach the courses, and they're conducting research. So you're learning from these clinicians, and most residencies are 3 to 4 years, depending on the discipline. And then during that process, you are also working to get published 3 times. By publish, you are submitting case studies, and you are getting them approved to be published in peer-reviewed journals. And once you accomplish 3 of those, you've completed your residency, you sit for board certification, and that's just 3 days of rigorous examinations in your specialty. And once you pass that test, you've checked all the boxes, you are now a bona fide veterinary specialist. So the common ones we hear about are surgeons, we hear about cardiologists, we hear about ophthalmologists, we hear about oncologists. Oncologists are cancer specialists. The ones that we don't tend to think about as much, not because they're any less impressive, but you know, the clients don't really interact with them quite commonly, but that would be radiologists. Those are board-certified imaging specialists that read CTs and ultrasound scans and x-rays all day long. And if there's like some ambiguity on a certain set of x-rays, something that looks anomalous to me, I will send it off to a radiologist for a fee. We pass that fee on to the client, and then I convey the findings to the client. And it can either confirm or maybe disagree with my findings, but it gives us more insight on the case. Client never actually meets the radiologist. I actually don't meet them either. I usually just read their report. So, and there's a whole other, you know, there's pathologists, there's, you know, I can go on down the line here and specialties, but those are some of the more common ones. So that's your direct route, straight up, and you know what? These people are impressive. The work ethic it takes, the intelligence, the talent, the discipline, the dedication to stay the course. Interns and residents don't get paid much of anything. I believe that residents, when I was at University of Illinois Teaching Hospital in my fourth year, those residents, I believe, were getting paid $20,000 a year, working like 80 hours a week. I don't recall exactly how that breaks down to as far as hourly wage when you look at it. But one of the residents that I worked under when I was a student, he said it was somewhere between $2 and $3 an hour is what they were making that's barely a livable wage. But again, the payoff is that you are getting an incredible education. So that's the direct route. My favorite kind of specialist is the indirect route one. So these guys or ladies have come out of school, they jump into general practice. And they're going to do general practice for 3-5 years or longer. And they decide to specialize and then apply for a residency at some point. And then they do the residency thing. And then the rest of the process is the same. So generally speaking, these veterinarians are working in the real world. We call it the real world because general practice is very different from a teaching setting, academic setting. We call it academia. Because they're going to do that for about 5 years, and that's considered, you know, equivalent to seeing rotating intern type number of high level cases. So it's not that 5 years of general practice is the same as a rotating internship. You just see a lot of stuff that's not necessarily high-end medicine, so a lot of vomiting and diarrhea, a lot of skin allergies, insect bites, foreign body obstructions, and kennel cough, and things like that. And in between, you're going to get these high-level cases, high-level surgeries that add up. But in a rotating internship, you're not seeing the vomiting and diarrhea and that mundane stuff. That's staying in general practice. Everything you're seeing is a very complex, complicated case. And in general practice, it takes a lot more time to get exposure to those types of cases. And it's generally agreed that, you know, that's roughly about 5 years, depending on the practice that you work in. When I came out of school, I worked in a very, very, very busy, very state-of-the-art, very self-sufficient general practice, where the culture in that practice was to go out of your way to learn things that are in the realm of specialty and get proficient at it. And so we did not refer a whole lot to specialty centers because we didn't have to. And I'm going to get to my point in just a moment. So what I like about these specialists is that they've experienced life in the real world prior to you know, going back to their specialty level medicine to do their residencies. And the reason that's important is real world considerations are very important. I find the specialists that have gone the indirect route and they've done some general practice, they have sort of, again, I don't want to generalize, but they have a different demeanor about them altogether. They're more readily available to the client. They tend to have really good bedside manners. They also seem to be more readily available to the referring veterinarian, which would be me. Great examples, our local ophthalmologist, Dr. Paige Evans. She was a class ahead of me, actually, in vet school, and she went the indirect route, and I could just see the difference palpably between her and some other specialists out there where the clients really feel that she's an extension of us in the way she's treated, in the humility by which she approaches them, and the time that she gives them. Because she had life as a general practitioner, and as a general practitioner, you get to see the same pets over and over again. You see the same clients over and over again, and you really fully get a grasp of the familial aspect of the crucial role you play in their family's life, because the pet is the fabric of, or part of the fabric of that family. And they also get to understand you as a practitioner that, you know, you are human as well. And I'm getting to know you so well that, you know what, you experiences all of the human layers of life that we do. And you take your job home with you like everybody else does sometimes. The stress can get to you like everybody else. You have children. You know, they learn just about you personally. And as a result, they have more empathy for you. And so they'll be more patient. So, for example, if I you know, didn't call somebody back on an urgent call as quickly as I would have liked to, they're patient with that because they know that my life is insane. And, you know, sometimes there's just a huge queue and then, oh my God, I got to leave. I got to get my son to swim practice, right? And so there's a better understanding across the board. Whereas I find that some of these specialists that didn't have that real world experience and they're not seeing the same people over and over again, because once they have solved the problem, they're kicking that case right back to the general practitioner who will, you know, then continue to provide the general veterinary care. But the specialists that have had real world experience, I have a special place for them. Now, again, if there's any technicians that work for specialists that did not take the indirect route, that was, you know, straight through academia to the finish line, or if there's any specialists that are actually listening to this program, please don't take it personally. You guys are so impressive. You ladies are so impressive. And very often the bedside manner's there and all that good stuff is there. And I'm just saying, more commonly, the indirect guys and ladies tend to, I guess, more consistently convey that. And I think it's a really cool thing. So folks out there, if you need a specialist, name your specialty, dermatology, surgery, whatever. Look at, you know, if you have an option and maybe a few choices out there, take a look and read the resumes. Look at what they did. See if there was some general practice in there in the mix at some point that led them to get back into the academic circles and hone their specialty that they're now in, but they did experience life in the real world for some time. I think, you know, it's worth at least looking at. I'm not saying necessarily pick them simply because of that. Look at the whole resume, look at reviews, look at all of that nuance. Listen to your veterinarian. We have a feel for what specialists we tend to favor over others. I favor specialists not necessarily I don't throw a blanket on, oh, you know, I'm going to go with this one necessarily because they've had general practice experience, because expertise is extremely important. Bedside manner is extremely important. And it's not necessarily a rule that a specialist with general practice experience is necessarily going to have a bedside manner. There's general practitioners out there that don't have a great bedside manner. It's just, you know, that's very individual. And that's not just specialists, that's general practitioners across the board. So It remains multifactorial, but I want to tell you a cool story before I check out here, is that a general practitioner, later to be third-year senior resident in surgery, changed the trajectory of my life. And I'm so glad I ended up on this guy's rotation. His name was Dr. John Haberjack. Dr. Haberjack, if you're listening, you're out there, or anybody knows John Haberjack, tell him to tune in because he changed my life. So when I was in veterinary school, my special interest has always been surgery. From the minute I opened my first surgical textbook to doing surgical rotation in the veterinary teaching hospital, I've just always loved surgery. I just like the definitiveness of it, that you can definitively fix something. Now, it's not that it's always going to work necessarily, but most of the time it does. And it's a definitive thing. It's like something's broken and you mend it back together. You know, I just love that. So here I am. I'm on orthopedic surgery rotation, and I mesh with senior resident, Dr. John Haberjack. And when you're in surgery, once you get through the real highly technical and stressful part of it, a lot of it's closing, and I'm just positioning the limb for the surgeon as his student, and you're just chatting a lot, and you know, that part of it's kind of mundane, and you just kind of automatic as you're closing. So Dr. Haberjack asked me, he's like, "So what are your career goals?" I said, "I want to be a surgeon just like you." He goes, "Like a specialist? You want to specialize in surgery, be board certified?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Yeah, don't." And I said, "Why? I mean, like, this what you're doing?" He goes, "Yeah, I wish I never did it." He goes, "I'm already this far along. There's no going back. I'm almost done, so I'm going to stick it through. And yeah, I'll be a surgical specialist. But, you know, in hindsight, I should have just stayed in general practice and gone another direction." And I said, "But look at all the cool things that you're able to do." And he goes, "I could have done it even as a general practitioner." And he goes, "Look, man," he's like, "I don't know about you, but I am a free spirit." Dr. Haberjack's from California, very California boy. He said to me, "I'm a free spirit, and all the ass-kissing that goes on around here, all of the higher-level academics that have never spent a second of their lives outside of a teaching hospital and the real world, there is a level of arrogance that I have no tolerance for." He said, these are his words, by the way. He said, "I got to eat shit and say yummy on a daily basis from the chief of surgery." It was a lady. I'm not going to say her name. Don't want to disparage anyone's reputation. But he said, "I got to eat shit and say yummy from Dr. So-and-so on a daily basis." He goes, "And you know what? Too often, the ones that are getting your head aren't the ones with the most talent. They're the ones that have the biggest capacity and audacity to kiss ass." He's like, "It's no way to live." He's like, "You make peanuts." He goes, "I feel like I'm like eating ramen every day, living in my one-bedroom studio and barely able to even get a pair of sneakers when I need a new pair of sneakers with this stipend that they pay me." He kind of burned through his savings that he was able to put away while working as a general practitioner. But his advice to me was this. He goes, "Do what you want, man. But what I would do is get into a very high-level general practice. It's busy. You're going to get exposed to a lot. You want to have mentors ahead of you that have been mentored themselves to do some higher-end surgeries that a lot of GPs may not necessarily do. So you can learn directly from them to do these procedures. And anything they don't know how to do and you're interested in it, take a course, get certified in that procedure, and now you can do it as well as anybody, as well as any board-certified surgeon." He goes, "And you know what else? As a board-certified surgeon, I got to do every damn surgery." He goes, "There's some surgeries I just don't like to do." He said, "For example, I don't like ass surgery." He goes, "I don't like doing surgery on butts. It doesn't do it for me." He said, "Soft tissue surgery in general, not really my thing. I'm really an orthopedics guy." So still, though, he's like, "I'm on orthopedic rotation right now. Guess where I got to go next and hate my life for a month? I got to go to soft tissue surgery." He's like, "Eh, just don't like it." He goes, "But as a board certified surgeon, I got to do everything." He goes, "You can just niche yourself. You can pick and choose what higher end stuff you're going to do." And he goes, you'll be making a real paycheck right out of school. It's not a ton of money, but it's sure a heck of a lot better than $20,000 a year. That was back in 2001 when I was a fourth-year student. But just very interesting perspective. So guess what I did? I met a girl that year as well, and we ended up really hitting it off, and we decided we were going to get engaged, and she was going to move back to New York with me. I was at University of Illinois, and she, you know, I thought to myself, well, you know, going to get engaged here, maybe a family shortly thereafter. I think I need to start making a real paycheck right out of the gate. And I'm going to follow Dr. Haberjack's advice. And so I did. I ended up at this really amazing practice on the North Shore of Long Island that checked all the boxes that Dr. Haberjack checked. Before I left there, I was doing a surgery called a perineal urethrostomy, which is a urethral rerouting surgery you do in cats that chronically obstruct. And you essentially shorten and widen their urethra, essentially make them more like a female. I was repairing diaphragmatic hernias from traumatic injury. I was repairing cranial cruciate ligament tears of the canine knee. I was repairing medially luxating patellas of the canine knee. I mean, I could go on and on with the expertise that I came out of there with. And by the time I was on my own and taking over my own practice, where I was a single practitioner for a while, there was something that I wanted to learn. I got the certification. I did the continuing education, did the surgical labs. And by then, I was so proficient in surgery that when you do these courses, the principles of surgery, you just apply them to this particular new procedure, and you're proficient in it in no time. And you can provide these services for the pet owner at much less cost in the clinic that is right there in their town where they've been going for years. Perhaps it's their second, third, or fourth pet with you at this point, and they're just comfortable with your staff. They're comfortable with the facility. They're comfortable with the veterinarian, and they don't have to go anywhere. And there's really a lot to be said for that. And then, you know, I got that all from an almost board-certified surgeon, and I Googled him the other day just to see where he was at in life, and I kind of came up with the idea for this episode. And he's still a boarded surgeon. He's out in a private referral practice out in Northern California, and looks very happy. And I hope he's able to just do his niche, which is orthopedics. It didn't say specifically on the website, but thank you, Dr. Haberjack, for changing my life. So, you know, that's in a nutshell. I do just love specialists that have had, you know, some foot in the real world, because it's very, very different. You know, you are dealing with real people and real families, and not just, you know, a case that has been referred, and you're going to know these people for maybe a week or two if it's a surgery. If it's an internal medicine case, you might know them for a little bit longer than that. And then, boom, they're out of your life. And, you know, it's hard to build relationships like that. And it I think it creates a certain sterileness to that level of medicine sometimes. And I find that the ones that have had the experience and the warmth that comes with being a general practitioner kind of add that little bit of flavor to it. That's my show, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in. In case you already haven't done it, I have a public professional page. Just do a search, Roger Welton DVM. No dots in the DVM, just DVM. Roger Welton DVM, friend me there. I'm doing Facebook Live little shorts, posting the links for this podcast on the timeline there as well. Tonight, I am not tonight, but next week, I'm going to be doing a Ask Dr. Roger event where you can log in and post questions and you know, ask me questions in real time while I'm on the air there for about 30 or so minutes. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. I'll talk to you next week.